loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at Donald Trump's State of the Union address. He spoke about immigration, the so-called wall, Afghanistan, Syria, Korea, the state of the economy. We're going to analyze and assess what he said and also pivot to the Democratic Party's response from Stacey Abrams and a second response from U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. First, the U.S. Senate yesterday voted 77-23 to allow states to penalize businesses that participate in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. The bill, which also includes measures aimed at prolonging U.S. troop presence in Syria and Afghanistan, goes to the House of Representatives for consideration today. Even though the bill had broad support in the Senate, several senators, including Vermont's Bernie Sanders and Kentucky's Rand Paul, opined that the measure was likely unconstitutional and would be overturned. Then, a report published this morning by the human rights group Amnesty International concludes that the United Arab Emirates is illegally supplying advanced American weaponry to Yemeni militias and other factions there. The report describes how the UAE has become what Amnesty International calls, quote, a major conduit, unquote, for armored vehicles, mortar systems, and guns to groups accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. A parallel CNN investigation found that both the UAE and Saudi Arabia were transferring U.S. weapons to Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Yemen. And finally, it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. Today we focus on Trump's comments last night on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty with Russia that was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. And in other headlines, Juan Guaido, the head of the suspended Venezuelan National Assembly, who proclaimed himself president, is sending a delegation to Italy. When the United States recognized and promoted his claim to the presidency, many of the EU governments eventually agreed and backed Guaido as well, but Italy is one of several that has not. Italy's far-right interior minister, Matteo Salvini, will meet with Guaido's team today. NATO and the government of the newly renamed Republic of North Macedonia signed an agreement today, paving the way for that country to become part of the military alliance. North Macedonia's entry into NATO had been delayed for more than two decades as a result of a dispute with Greece, which complained that the country's name reflected cultural appropriation and its constitution called for an annexation of the Greek province of Macedonia. North Macedonia's accession to NATO now will go through a ratification process that is unlikely to be concluded before next year. Today, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring admitted to wearing blackface in college. This comes after the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, admitted to the same thing last week, and Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax was accused of sexual assault. All three are Democrats. The next in line for the governorship after Fairfax and Herring is Republican State House Speaker Kirk Cox. A new report issued by NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found that 2018 was the fourth hottest year ever recorded. The 3 years that were hotter were 2015, 2016, and 2017. Top UN climate scientists have found that the world has until 2030 before the most catastrophic effects of climate change become irreversible. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Well, of course, one of the big stories of the week, of course, will be what happened last night, Donald Trump's State of the Union. Anyway, Jackie, what's your take on that? And then I want to be able to play the Democratic response, which was Stacey Abrams. And Bernie Sanders had his own response and quite different from Stacey Abrams' response. So anyway, we're going to talk about that. But let's talk first about what Donald Trump said.
That wasn't a State of the Union address. That was a case for declaring a national emergency in a couple of weeks. Speech. That was a 2020 campaign speech. That was really like, it sounded like it could have come from a bad writing for the script of Man in the High Castle. It was like the most, one of the most nationalistic, divisive, hateful speeches that I've heard in a very long time from a sitting president. Just the things that he said in regard to immigrants, immigration, what's allegedly going on at the border, just the most hateful, blatant lies. But he's not talking to anybody but his base. He knows he's not able to make a case to anyone who is already opposed to him and his policies. He's really just trying to encourage his base to stick with him and continue to support him and continue to give him cover so he can continue to trample on civil liberties and basically rob people blind by distracting them with this wall business while he admittedly is going to outspend every other country in the world to build up our nuclear weapons arsenal. It was a nightmare, this speech last night.
Walter, what's your take?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it was just like all of the most horrible things you could imagine packed into one. I mean, there's ridiculousness about how, you know, the U.S. economy is amazing, the hottest economy in the world right now, by far. Everybody agrees. I mean,
which wasn't even remotely true, by the way.
Right. I mean, and how do you even measure that? It's so outrageous. I mean, in like the most unequal society, you know, in human history. Then there was the heavy focus on anti-immigrant racism, you know, talking about all the horrible crimes that were committed, you know, which is basically something that's become like a hallmark of any kind of major Donald Trump speech, whether that's on the campaign trail or, you know, something that he does while he's in office. You know, there was the stuff about the First Step Act, right, where he sort of tried to maybe posture a little bit like a progressive person. But I mean, I was pretty like the stories of the people that he told. It was like, okay, if you're like an absolute saint, like if you get a sainthood after you get arrested, then maybe there can be a little bit of leniency or mercy or whatever. So, I mean, I thought that even that whole presentation was like a little bit offensive. And then you got into the foreign policy stuff where I'm glad that a Trump-Kim summit is happening, but I can't say that, you know, the Trump administration's foreign policy, and I'm also glad that hopefully, you know, the U.S. troops will be leaving Syria and Afghanistan. But I mean, there is all sorts of terrible stuff in there too. There is the support for the ongoing coup in Venezuela. He made sure to mention that and talk about Guaido, this fake imposter president that they're trying to impose. He talked about Iran. He talked, you know, in a very threatening manner about Iran. Reaffirming the U.S. support for Israel, an apartheid racial regime. And yeah, I mean, it was really, really bad.
John Kiriakou, this is a ritual. It didn't used to be. Originally, the State of the Union was sent as a letter to Congress.
That's right. Until actually, historically, recently, maybe a century ago, less than a century ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, we watched it together and we commented about it here on Radio Sputnik before and after the State of the Union. I think the thing went for an hour and 24 minutes.
Yeah,
it's very ritualistic. Here you have Congress doing this play acting because the Democrats are pretending to be hunkered down and angry, and the Republicans are clapping and chanting and ovating on cue. They're chanting this time, USA, USA, yeah. USA. I can't remember that like 30 years ago at the State of the Union.
I don't remember that post 9/11. Or I don't remember that in the days before the start of the Gulf War. I thought it was dangerously nationalistic. And, you know, let's also remember, too, that members of Congress have advanced copies of the State of the Union address. They've already read them and they know where the applause lines are. So a lot of that nonsensical nationalism is pre-planned.
Go ahead, Jackie.
There's so many. I actually didn't know that about the non-existence of these chants before. But now that I think about it, I can't remember them. I can't remember this kind of thing happening during a State of the Union address either. And it's I just sat there watching this thinking, man, this reminds me of like a cutting room floor kind of episode of Man in the High Castle. Like, you know, somebody was sick that day and tried to write, you know, the script for a speech. And the editors were like, nope, this isn't good enough to go into the show. Trump is like, he's like a poor and uninformed man's caricature of Hitler. And I know that's extremely inflammatory, but that's exactly what I thought last night when I watched him say these awful things. And I want to pick up on what Walter said about people having to be saints after while they're in prison. There was a strain of comments throughout his speech that spoke directly to the conservative Christian evangelical community. There was a reason he brought up that Alice Johnson and the other gentleman who was the first released under the First Step Act taught Bible study and became ministers in prison. And then he talked about the late-term abortion issue. And he made sure to mention that, you know, babies are made in the image of a holy God. Then he talks about Israel and moving the embassy to Jerusalem. All of that language was directed at the conservative Christian, very right-wing, a very pro-Israel, let me change that, very pro-Zionist religious community in this country. And it was so disingenuous, especially the part about Israel, because he said that they weren't, our approach is based on principled realism, not discredited theories that have failed for decades. Every aspect of the conservative Christian ideology is based on spiritual theory, all of it. Nothing is based on actual realism. So it's just, and these are people who will literally sacrifice every other person in this country to get their agenda of spiritual theories enshrined into law.
That's the voice of Jackie Lookman. Jacqueline Lookman is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. In this segment, we're focusing on Donald Trump's State of the Union message. I want to at some point talk about the Democratic Party's response. And there wasn't one response. Well, there was one official response. That was Stacey Abrams. And apparently she wrote her speech herself. It wasn't the Democratic Party.
Correct.
Then you had Bernie Sanders. I watched his Facebook delivered message last night very late. It was about, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes long. I want to talk about those things, but let's still go over some of the highlights of what Donald Trump actually said. One of the things that he did, Walter, was he accused Russia of violating the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Missile Treaty that was signed by Gorbachev and Reagan in the late 1980s. And then he basically, in Trumpian style, was heavily promoting, sort of backslapping, chest thumping, a new arms race. He said there could be a new treaty. It could be signed. It could include China this time, because, of course, China's military has developed significantly since the mid-1980s. But he said, if there's no new treaty, we're going to outspend and out-innovate every other country in the world. And again, the chant went up, USA, USA, USA. I'm thinking like, wow, so many working class families can't make ends meet. I mean, literally, there's food insecurity everywhere in this rich country. So many working class families can't pay rent. They can't really go to a doctor or they can't have a decent healthcare plan. And the Congress is chanting USA, USA, USA about outspending Russia for more missiles.
Yeah, it's an example of why the U.S. is not really a democracy, I don't think. I mean, no matter who the president is, no matter who voters choose every 4 years or 2 years to run in Congress or to occupy the White House, the U.S. military-industrial complex, the U.S. empire, that basic logic of world domination, it never changes. It cannot possibly change because, you know, no matter what, we see there's a clear progression. It always goes in one direction. So you know, take the issue of nuclear weapons. So the Obama administration, right, who is a Democrat, who was elected in 2008 in large part because the U.S. public rejected the George W. Bush administration's war in Iraq, particularly. Not only did he amp up all those, you know, conflicts, I mean, there's some moving around of troops, but I mean, in aggregate, there are more U.S. wars around the world. The Obama administration also announced a $1 trillion modernization program of the U.S. Nuclear arsenal, making it both more deadly, right, you know, more destructive, as though that were necessary. I mean, the U.S. already has enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world many, many times over, but also to make some of them more usable, meaning that they would actually have a smaller payload, and therefore, you know, U.S. battlefield commanders would have more tactical flexibility to use the nuclear weapons, like to actually use them. So that was a Democrat. That was Obama. And then Donald Trump got elected. And you know what? On the campaign trail, he actually sounded like to the left of Barack Obama or to pretty much any Democrat who occupies elected office, because he was, you know, he was talking about the consequences, the negative consequences of U.S. military intervention from a completely opportunistic and phony point of view, you know, or standpoint or motivations. But he was talking about it and people liked it. And what happened when he got into office? Well, the military industrial complex, the U.S. empire, just kept going in the same direction, regardless of the will of the voters, because now Donald Trump is withdrawing from the INF treaty. I mean, one of these sort of landmark, like, end of the Cold War agreements. He's also, I mean, you know, pushing forward with the modernization program and now at the State of the Union threatening to amp up that nuclear arms race and doing all sorts of other things to you know, push forward what the Pentagon calls great power competition, also known as preparations for World War III against China and against Russia.
Jackie, I know you have a limited amount of time this morning, and we're going to be joined later in this segment by Jim Kavanaugh to talk more about Donald Trump's State of the Union address. We're analyzing it. We're assessing it. We're also assessing the Democratic Party's response. I want to talk about Stacey Abrams' response. I want to talk about this. Now, Stacey Abrams, obviously, it's obvious to anyone who is paying attention to Georgia politics, ran for governor. It was a very, you know, stimulating race, a black woman possibly going to be the governor of Georgia. People were excited. There was lots of evidence of voter suppression. She alluded to it last night. She also made this, I thought, fairly bizarre pitch for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party under Donald Trump to work together no matter what. She in fact said the country's national politics should resemble the politics in Georgia, where Republicans and Democrats,
I didn't understand that,
come together.
All.
And I'm thinking, like, wait, isn't that the state that just carried out the voter suppression that deprived you, Stacey Abrams, of the election? But there's another thing. Stacey Abrams, since the election, has become an employee for the Center for American Progress. Now, the Center for American Progress is an organization led by former Obama and Hillary Clinton officials, meaning people who were in the Obama administration and people who were also directly associated with Hillary Clinton's campaign, including John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairperson. The Center for American Progress opposed Bernie Sanders' legislative initiative for Medicare for All. So, again, that's who Stacey Abrams is now working for. Anyway, let's play a short audio clip, Jackie Lookman, of it's sort of towards the end, or maybe it's the very end of Stacey Abrams' response, and then I want to get you to respond.
So, even as I am very disappointed by the president's approach to our problems, I still don't want him to fail. But we need him to tell the truth and to respect his duties and respect the extraordinary diversity that defines America. Our progress has always been found in the refuge, in the basic instinct of the American experiment. To do right.
Okay, Jackie Lookman, go ahead.
I do not understand the Democrats' continual call for politicians like Donald Trump. And it's not just him, but it's politicians who have repeatedly shown that they really don't care about the American people. They don't care about truth. They don't care about integrity. Why do we keep asking these people or demanding that they suddenly do something that they have never, ever done? Whether people want Trump to fail, I think, is irrelevant, because he has. You can't lie that much and call yourself the president of the United States and never say anything that is actually true about the state of the American, not just the economy, but the society in this country where people are feeling unrepresented. They're certainly feeling economic pressures, and there's continued discrimination, and there's a rise in racist and sexist and homophobic violence going on. This administration has absolutely failed, but also our politics in general have failed. And I feel like Abrams has done what Democrats always do at the very end of her her response to the State of the Union, which was to kind of put a pretty face on telling the truth. Like, she wants Donald Trump to tell the truth, but she's not really telling the truth about the dire situation we're facing. And that is the Democrats' weakness. I think her response contained some good points, but at the end there, this olive branch that she extended to Trump, you know, say, I don't want him to fail and we need to work together and we need him to do things that he is clearly incapable of doing. I think that is such a clear example of the weakness of the Democratic Party.
You know, I actually have a question for Jackie, because this is something that I was struggling with last night as I was watching this thing, is what are the Democrats so afraid of? Why do they feel compelled to say the things that they are saying, Jackie?
The Democrats, I think, are afraid of responsibility and actually having to lead. The Democrats are afraid of answering to the people who want something different from what the Democratic Party is already offering. I mean, the Democratic Party isn't really offering anything much different in the way of pandering to corporate interests that the Republican Party is offering. The Republicans are just doing it in a more obvious, blatant, ham-fisted way. The Democratic Party, by and large, doing the same things. The people want Medicare for all. Democrats don't. Neither do the Republicans. The people want an infrastructure bill, a jobs guarantee, reduced pharmaceutical costs. The people do not want this wall. The Democrats really aren't in support of any of those things. Neither are the Republicans. So the Democrats, I think, are afraid of being exposed to the people for being pretty much just like the party they're supposed to be resisting.
That's the voice of Jackie Lookman. Jackie, we want to thank you for joining us. I know you have to run, so we'll talk to you on Friday when we do our segment called The Week in Review. Walter Smolarek, again, Center for American Progress. That's who Stacey Abrams represents now, or that's who she works for. Neera Tanden, the president of the Center for American Progress, has been on a roll against Jill Stein, attacking Jill Stein as a, quote, useful idiot, I believe that's the language, of the Kremlin, and making the argument that the reason Hillary Clinton lost was not only Russian interference to help Donald Trump, but because Jill Stein was another part of that plank, that campaign, that conspiracy by the Kremlin, and making the argument that because Jill Stein existed in the 2016 campaign and got more than a million votes, and some of those votes were in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, those battleground states, that the reason Hillary Clinton lost those states was because of Jill Stein. Again, that's the Center for American Progress.
The Democratic Party leadership, and especially people like the Center for American Progress, are always so much more aggressive attacking people to their left than attacking the people who are, you know, maybe just like an inch or two to the right, otherwise known as the Republican Party. You know, and like when you were sitting there listening to this speech last night, you know, a lot of listeners might be wondering, like, wow, this is terrible. Like, how did we get to this point? Like, how did we get to the point where in the State of the Union address, you know, the president can pack in so many horrible far right positions all in the course of just a little bit over an hour? And I think that, you know, of course, the extreme right wingers in the Republican Party, the Tea Party, you know, the billionaires who back them, of course, they deserve a huge amount of that credit or a huge amount of that blame. But I think that the people at the Center for American Progress and the political tendency that they represent also have a huge amount of responsibility for the state that U.S. society is in right now, because this is, I mean, this is the way the rightward drift in U.S. politics works, right? So the Republican Party comes out with some extreme right-wing policy like the Muslim ban, which seems completely unthinkable, or you know, $1 trillion of tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and the corporations, something that sounds so ridiculously impossible, or the privatization of Social Security. And then the Democratic Party says something just a little bit less extreme than that. Like, okay, well, we'll just cut Social Security a little bit. We'll just raise the retirement age by a couple years. Or, you know, well, we'll just, you know, have the NSA spy on everybody, but we won't actually ban anyone from coming into the United States from a Muslim-majority country. And then all of the people who, you know, are rightfully disgusted by the Republican Party's policies, but who feel, because of the structure of U.S. politics, the two-party system, feel some sense of fealty to the Democratic Party, say, yeah, that's right, we're going to do this slightly less horrible thing rather than this really, really bad thing that was proposed by the Republicans. And so every election cycle, it goes further and further and further to the right until we get Donald Trump giving the speech that he gave last night.
That's Walter Smolarek. We're going to take a break in about 2 minutes and come back. We're going to have Jim Kavanaugh with us to talk more about Trump's State of the Union and the Democrats' response. Before we go to the break, though, I want to hear the other Democrats' response. I mean, Bernie Sanders is not officially a Democrat, but really functioning within the Democratic Party. His message was significantly different than the message delivered by Stacey Abrams. Let's listen.
Despite huge increases in productivity, sadly, millions of American workers are now forced to work two or three jobs just to pay the bills and to keep their heads above water economically. In America today, and somehow or another, President Trump didn't mention this in his speech, we have more wealth and income inequality than almost any major country on earth. And it is more unfair, more unequal now than at any other time since the Gilded Age of the 1920s. Yes, the economy is great for the three wealthiest people in America who own more wealth than the bottom half of our country, 160 million Americans. Yes, the economy is great for the top 1% who now earn 46% of all new income in our economy. Yes, the economy is great for the top 25 hedge fund managers on Wall Street.
John Kiriakou, I mean, that's a different message. Bernie Sanders is ripping income inequality. I mean, that's a message that actually could appeal to working class voters who may not be committed to either party.
And that's the message that the Democratic Party should have been conveying last night. That's the message that should have come in the official Democratic response, because we've got a serious problem in this country with income inequality. The Democrats need to stake out a position independent of the Republicans. This is a position, or this would be a position, and an issue that is relevant to millions of Americans. And frankly, isn't it up to the Democrats to be the party that talks about poverty in this country?
Yeah. And of course, I think the Democrats won't do that.
They will not.
Because even though it would be electorally clever, they won't do it because they're wedded to the same Wall Street corporations, Wall Street banks and corporations that the Republicans are. So this is
absolutely
obviously
right.
This is obviously a compelling message and a good message to contrast with Trump. Anyway, that's Bernie Sanders. I don't think it's going to be the Democratic Party. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. We're going to talk to Jim Kavanaugh. We're going to continue this discussion about Trump's State of the Union and the Democratic Party's response.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday. That means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. In this second half hour of In the News, we're going to be joined by Jim Kavanaugh from New York. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're also joined again in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jim Kavanaugh, Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to focus again in this half hour on Donald Trump's State of the Union address and the response from the Democrats. The formal one was by Stacey Abrams, who was the Democratic Party
nominee for the gubernatorial race in Georgia. She lost. We're also going to hear from Bernie Sanders, not the official Democratic Party response, but he made his own statement. I believe it was broadcast on Facebook shortly after the State of the Union. Jim Kavanaugh, a big part of Trump's State of the Union message was, again, naturally and predictably about immigration and about his absolute commitment to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexican border. Let's listen to Donald Trump and what he said.
My administration has sent to Congress a common sense proposal to end the crisis on the southern border. It includes humanitarian assistance, more law enforcement, drug detection at our ports, closing loopholes that enable child smuggling, and plans for a new physical barrier or wall to secure the vast areas between our ports of entry. In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
So there's Donald Trump again telling Congress he's sending a package to make border security better still, the need for a wall. He also introduced a guest who he brought to the State of the Union, and this is what he said. Here tonight is Deborah Bissell. Just 3 weeks ago, Deborah's parents, Gerald and Sharon, were burglarized and shot to death in their Reno, Nevada home by an illegal alien. They were in their 80s and survived, and are survived by 4 children, 11 grandchildren, and 20 great-grandchildren. Also here tonight are Gerald and Sharon's granddaughter, Heather, and great-granddaughter, Madison. To Deborah, Heather, Madison, please stand. Few can understand your pain, but I will never forget, and I will fight for the memory of Gerald and Sharon, that it should never happen again. Not one more American life should be lost because our nation failed to control its very dangerous border. Jim Kavanaugh, I mean, this is the rankest kind of opportunism, using immigrants as a punching bag and making the actually untrue case that immigrants are the basic and primary threat to individual security here in the United States.
Yeah, it really is disgusting. I mean, to use a family like this, I don't know this situation. All I know about this is what I read and heard from Donald Trump. But, you know, a family which has had a horrible thing like this happen to them and using them as a props for a political thing, which has really, you know, everybody, the statistics are clear. Crime by immigrants is lower than crime by non-immigrants. I mean, you can take any group of people and you're going to find criminals in it. This has nothing to do with the issue of immigration. And it's a phony way and a nasty way of trying to scaremonger people. It's racist scaremongering, brown people scaremongering. It's what Trump did with the Central Park Five in New York. You know, it's really nasty stuff. And there's a whole set of things that have to do with people. This is what these politicians do. They like to have these props around, these people that they use as props. And I find it disgusting in a lot of ways. This one particularly, I think, is extremely nasty. And I'm not sure. I think Bernie Sanders said something about this, but it's just horrible, opportunistic fear-mongering.
And John Kiriakou, it comes from the president of the United States. He has a lot of supporters in the country. It sort of sets the tone. It sends a message to a lot of people who are looking to Trump, like, yeah, quote, illegal aliens. Again, they're not aliens. They're human beings. They're undocumented workers. They're coming to work. That they are the fundamental threat. And so if you are faced with a fundamental threat, then you, in self-defense, you sort of lash out. And you and I were watching the show last night. We were covering this speech live. And I'm not making a direct comparison between Donald Trump and other earlier historical political leaders. But when you think about what happened in Germany with the deliberate scapegoating of Jews and people from East Europeans or Roma people or gay people, this is the kind of toxic racism now being promoted from by the president of the United States. And I want to get your reaction, and then I want to hear Bernie Sanders' reaction.
This was not a unifying speech. I think that the commentators that we saw last night and even today in the print media, I think they're focusing on the wrong thing. They're talking about whether or not the speech was presidential, whether or not the president got his message across, was he able to convey his policy. I think that's not what we should be talking about. What we should be talking about is, was this speech unifying or divisive? It was divisive. there was scapegoating. Scapegoating of undocumented workers and others who just are not a part of the president's plan to make America white again, or whatever it is that he's trying to do. And there was nothing that he said that would lead me to believe that anything is going to improve in the next 2 years, whether it's Democrats leading the House of Representatives or Republicans. It really made no difference.
Let's listen to Bernie Sanders. Sanders, of course, it was not the official Democratic Party response, but he did go and have a Facebook-based, a Facebook live stream. Let's listen. He speaks specifically to what happened in the case of Nevada.
Trump has talked time and time again about crimes committed by undocumented Latino immigrants. His demonization of Latinos is nothing less than racist. It is wrong, and it also happens to be factually inaccurate. Undocumented Latino immigrants commit fewer crimes in the United States than the general public. But I want you to think about something for a moment. Isn't it strange that when we talk about terrible crimes committed in the United States or in the state of Nevada, Donald Trump forgot to mention that in 2017, a white man named Stephen Paddock killed 58 people and wounded 851 in the deadliest shooting in modern American history.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders, he's right. I'm really glad he brought this out. Again, it's Nevada. I mean, how do you not mention what happened in Las Vegas when this psychotic white man shot so many people in such a short amount of time, and then you ignore that and you talk about this one terrible tragedy and crime. Again, Jim Kavanaugh, I think Bernie Sanders did the right thing here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's exactly right. I mean, you take a crime that's a horrible crime and use it as an exemplar for the class of people, everybody who's an undocumented, this represents what they do. But you don't do that when a white man does it. When an old white guy kills, I don't remember the number.
58 and 800 wounded.
More than 58 people. You don't say, oh, that's the kind of thing that white men do. It's really just obviously racist and fear-mongering and scapegoating. I mean, there's no other way of saying it. And the way in which the discourse shifts around from kind of inspiring cliches to all of a sudden you're in this, look at this horrible crime and this victim and this horrible people who are doing this and these kind of scary images. It's really, you know, it's hard to watch this stuff and it's hard to read it and certainly watch it. But, you know, it's scaremongering, and it's scaremongering against specific groups of people. You know, there's an issue about immigration, and he starts out talking about that issue in class terms. This is something that's taking jobs away, that's threatening America. And then all of a sudden you're in this horror show, this horror movie, you know, the latest serial killer of the week movie, slasher movie with this thing. And it has nothing to do with the issue. You know, you could have a serious discussion about immigration. This isn't it. This is just provoking racist response and getting people riled up over what's really a horror show.
That's Jim Kavanaugh. We're joined by Jim to talk about the news of the week. And right now we're focusing on Donald Trump's State of the Union address. Walter Smolarek is also a guest here. Walter is a Sputnik News analyst. I want to turn now to some of the foreign policy issues in Trump's speech. And in particular, let's listen to what he said about Venezuela. And then I want to get both of your comments. Let's listen to Donald Trump last night talking about his decision about who the government in Venezuela actually is.
2 weeks ago, the United States officially recognized the legitimate government of Venezuela and its new president, Juan Guaido. We stand with the Venezuelan people in their noble quest for freedom, and we condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime, whose socialist policies have turned that nation from being the wealthiest in South America into a state of abject poverty and despair.
He went on to proclaim that the United States will never be a socialist country, too, which I thought was extremely inspiring.
And quite funny, actually.
And I actually disagree with him about that. But Walter...
Nancy Pelosi was clapping when he said that.
Yeah. And, you know, he says, we have recognized the new president of Venezuela, the legitimate government. They didn't recognize him. They picked him.
They installed him.
They installed him. Go ahead, Walter.
Yeah, no, nobody had any idea who this guy was in Venezuela. I mean, there were opinion polls. I mean, truly, like 80% of the people, you know, in this one opinion poll, at least, had never heard of Juan Guaido before. He wasn't the leader of one of the main opposition parties. He wasn't even the deputy leader of one of the main opposition parties. He was like third, maybe fourth in command of like the most far right wing of the major parties in the opposition coalition. So, right. I mean, the like applause from all those members of Congress. I mean, you would think, oh, wow, they must have been following this guy's career for a long time. For like 100% certainty that not a single person in that room had heard of Juan Guaido until the U.S. government declared that he was the president of Venezuela. And now, so, I mean, the other ironic part is that President Nicolas Maduro is the elected president. He was elected back in May. All the international observers said that it was, you know, a clean election. It wasn't stolen. Jimmy Carter has said that Venezuela has the best election system in the world. And so now Donald Trump, with the bipartisan support of the elites in the United States, is trying to provoke not just a coup, but actually, well, I mean, possibly an invasion, a U.S. military campaign, along with other, you know, right-wing and far-right governments in Latin America, to bring about chaos in Venezuela with the hopes that they can install a compliant regime. That would allow the United States to resume what they had been doing in Venezuela for many, many decades prior, which is plundering the country's oil wealth.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, the United States intervened and crushed the Iraqi government. Iraq had the second largest oil reserves in the Middle East after Saudi Arabia. Right? That was
correct.
2003.
Yep.
In 2011, the United States, Britain, and France intervened under the banner of NATO to destroy the Libyan government. Libya had the largest oil reserves in Africa. Wasn't the largest oil producer, but the largest oil reserves. And now Venezuela, 95% of Venezuela's budget is national budget is based on oil sales. Of course, I think one of the big issues for Maduro and for the Venezuelan government was oil prices plummeted. The price of a barrel of oil was about 110 or 112. And then after the economic crisis triggered by what happened on Wall Street in 2008, the price of oil went down to about $28 a barrel. Nonetheless, do you think oil is a factor here, Jim Kavanaugh?
Of course it is. Of course it is. It can't not be. And the United States has been, I think, helping to try and engineer over years the decline in the oil prices because it hurts Russia and it hurts Venezuela. But I think we also have to understand that this is blatant naked imperialism. As you say, this guy was appointed by Pence over on a phone call over, you know, the night before he swore himself in. But it's also, and the United States wants to get control of the oil. John Bolton has said so. Donald Trump says nothing else but that about all interventions. He said we should just take the oil, and certainly he wants to do that. But there's something else going on here, which everybody has to, you know, also, that the United States wants to put the Venezuelan oligarchy back in total political control of the country. It's a class issue also. The United States is not just out to plunder resources. That's not all of what imperialism is about. It's about protecting class power in these countries. And in Venezuela, you've had a situation where working class people, where you have real democratization, working class people are energized and they vote and they organize in their communities and the government institutions and social programs have empowered them. And the Venezuelan oligarchy, which controlled the country, which was in horrible shape, and everybody says it before Chavez came in under Cabrillas, that was the failure of capitalism, but nobody talks about that. You know, which had, and the Bolivarian policies have helped the majority of workers, working people in Venezuela. And what the oligarchy is furious about is that they don't have all the power and they want it all back. And the United States wants to help them get it all back. It should be clear to everybody what you're looking at here is imperialism, which is a resource grab, at least indirect control of resources. And it's also putting the bourgeoisie or the oligarchy in Venezuela back into power and removing, crushing what has been the empowerment, the democratic empowerment of the majority of people of Venezuela. And it's going to take a very nasty and vicious thing to do that again. It's another Pinochet. And everybody who's looking at this has to understand you're choosing between Pinochet and Allende. And you can't make up some kind of humanitarian excuse for this or It's nothing to do with democracy. It's going to be less democratic. And it's a horrible situation to look at. And I will say, Bernie Sanders hasn't, his statement on this wasn't great. And his statement on this repeated a lot of the things about the brutality of the Maduro regime, the policies that have failed. You've got these tropes that are out there that are the received wisdom. Maduro is a dictator, which is ridiculous. As Walter said, tons of fair elections. He keeps winning them. The PSUV, the Venezuelan party, keeps winning them. And, you know, the socialist policies have failed. Well, you've had the most powerful country in the world for 20 years waging economic warfare against Venezuela, preventing it from even getting its assets, from making financial transactions. So, of course, the country is in a horrible state, and there may be a lot of problems that, from the government, but the United States, the most powerful country in the world, has done its best to make the economy scream, as it did in Chile. And this is a case of, you know, this failure of socialism here. The alleged failures of socialism are actually the crimes of capitalism. Failures of Venezuela socialism are the crimes of American capitalism trying to force the country to make the economy scream and to get people to accept again the reimposition of what's essentially a comprador government.
That's the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. John Kiriakou, I know you'll remember the writings of General
Smedley Butler. Oh, yes, indeed.
Major General of the U.S. Marines. He was the in charge of the U.S. for the Marines, the U.S. invasion of Haiti that began in 1915. It lasted for 19 years. 15,000 Haitians died. The first thing that the U.S. military did was they marched directly to the U.S., the central bank in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and they took all the gold out of the bank and put it on a boat and sent it to New York, where it was kept, taken into custody by the First City Bank of New York, now known as Citibank. Smedley Butler, you know, it was an unusual for a Marine major general to write after he retired, that he wrote, "War is a racket." He made a speech. Now, here we have Venezuela. Its gold has been seized by the government of the UK.
That's right.
Probably under the direction of the US. $1.2 billion of Venezuelan gold just seized by the British and given to the new selected government of Juan Guaido. So same thing that happened in Haiti in 1915. Same thing. It's 103 years later. Here's what General Smedley Butler wrote about that war and the other wars that he led. He said, "War is a racket, and it always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small, quote, inside, close quote, group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. Out of a war, a few people make huge fortunes."
How prescient was that?
That's a Marine major general who actually helped lead the invasion of Haiti.
And, you know, since it's appropriate that we're talking about Smedley Butler when we're talking about coups or attempted coups, right? Because the thing that made Smedley Butler, you know, switch sides, as it were, sort of go from the side of the war makers to the side of the people who desire peace, is that J.P. Morgan and the DuPont family, they asked him to organize a coup against FDR because they were opposed to the New Deal.
That's true.
And so Smedley Butler was like, okay, that's a bit too far. And then he, you know, fully embraced all these very important and courageous values that we're talking about. I think that, you know, there's a lot of parallels, and the operation of the U.S. empire really remains remarkably consistent over the years, even though there are, of course, changes.
Yeah, and there are differences in tactics, and I want to go to another audio clip. Time is running short here. This is another part of Donald Trump's speech. This is now about the Middle East and Central Asia. In other words, about Syria and Afghanistan. Let's listen.
"When I took office, ISIS controlled more than 20,000 square miles in Iraq and Syria just 2 years ago. Today, we have liberated virtually all of the territory from the grip of these bloodthirsty monsters. Now, as we work with our allies to destroy the remnants of ISIS, it is time to give our brave warriors in Syria a warm welcome home. I have also accelerated our negotiations to reach, if possible, a political settlement in Afghanistan. The opposing side is also very happy to be negotiating.
Okay, Jim Kavanaugh and Walter, the other side, I think, is the Taliban, which he mentioned by name. They're also very happy. He's happy that they're happy. It makes you kind of wonder, here we are on the 18th year of the war. A lot of people have died. There were no Afghans on those planes that struck the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. So Afghans had, the Afghan people, tens of thousands of whom have died, weren't part of it. You know, if the U.S. was going to sort of bring the Taliban to power, couldn't that have happened, say, in 2001?
That's right.
Yeah, this is a defeat that they're trying to mask as something else. It's a defeat, and it's a defeat that goes on for 17 years, as you say.
You declare victory and go home.
Yeah, I mean, right. Say it's victory. Say whatever you want. And, you know, he didn't say anything specific about we're going to actually leave Afghanistan. He's made statements about even Syria. Are they actually going to leave all the troops from the Al-Tanf base? You know, there's a lot of pressure that's going to be brought by people in his administration, including Bolton, to keep some troops in Syria. And I'll believe that all the troops have gone when they're gone and not the day before. And I don't believe it's going to happen. So, and, you know, these talks in Afghanistan could go on for another 10 years. I mean, you know, they're very reluctant. They're going to be very reluctant to leave because people will see, especially in Afghanistan, what it is. And as far as the issue of the thing about ISIS in Syria, you know, that's such a phony thing, too. 2 days ago, I think, the United States bombed the Syrian forces in eastern Syria that were fighting ISIS. The only people that were helped, that are being helped now by American troops in Al-Tanf and American bombing of Syrian forces in eastern Syria is ISIS. So the United States isn't, and everybody knows, I mean, everybody could see, John Kerry admitted it and it was on tape that we weren't fighting ISIS. We were letting ISIS come in because we thought it would be helpful to us. We figured we'd get, take care of them later. So this whole idea, which is being promoted and accepted by everybody, that American military presence in Syria was about fighting ISIS, is phony.
Yeah, it is phony. I mean, it was really amazing to have Trump claim credit for defeating ISIS. I mean, even if it, I mean, the U.S. has a small, it's not a big component, not a big contingent of military troops in Syria. It can't be decisive. Russia was decisive, their intervention, Iranian troops. The Syrian Arab Army, I mean, they lost more than 150,000 soldiers fighting ISIS. You know, there are others who get credit for the defeat of ISIS, and the United States is not there because of ISIS. I want to, though, go, because time is running so short, I want to go to what Trump also said about Korea, because now there's going to be summit number two between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. It's going to be in Vietnam at the end of this month. Let's listen.
As part of a bold new diplomacy, we continue our historic push for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped, and there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected President of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea. Much work remains to be done. But my relationship with Kim Jong-un is a good one. Chairman Kim and I will meet again on February 27th and 28th in Vietnam.
All right. Walter Smolarek, there was a truce signed 65 years ago, July 27th, 1953, that brought the military conflict to an end. But the war didn't end. There's no peace treaty. The North Koreans have been demanding, insisting that before they denuclearize, before they, quote, disarm, and they won't fundamentally disarm anyway, there has to be a new relationship with the United States. It seems to me that the Trump administration, through its envoy, Stephen Biegun, who made a speech at Stanford University, has pretty much accepted that North Korea might be a nuclear power, at least in the short term, and that the Trump administration is willing to talk about a new relationship with North Korea. Is there a basis for optimism on this one?
I think the substance of this new relationship with North Korea, in addition to, you know, removing the threat or at least greatly diminishing the threat of warfare, is the opportunity for North Korea to basically re-enter the global economy. I mean, since the fall of the Soviet Union and its, you know, associated socialist governments around the world, and their imposition of devastating, absolute, you know, basically a blockade of North Korea from the world economy, from its trading partners. North Korea has been, you know, deeply impoverished, and the people suffer a lot under these sanctions. And so if there can be, you know, trade relations opened up between North Korea, not necessarily and the United States, but say South Korea, right, the southern half of the peninsula that was, you know, united for thousands of years prior to the U.S. War in 1950, then that would be something that could really energize the North Korean economy and alleviate the suffering of the people.
Jim Kavanaugh, what about Vietnam as the venue for the next summit? Is it significant in your mind?
Well, it's historically significant, ironic, you know, it's interesting to see. But I do want to say also that, again, Trump, I think, is to be given credit for what he's done with Korea. And he's under a lot of pressure, and I will not believe it, anything good is going to happen until it actually happens. And I think Bolton et al. Don't really want this to happen. There's going to be a lot of pressure. And the media and the political class are excoriating for this. Look, Donald Trump, one of the things that he won the election on was promising no more regime change and promising peacefulness. And if the Democrats wanted to defeat him again, they would show, look how contradictory he is. He wants peace with Korea, but he's attacking Venezuela. He wants this, but he's attacking Iran. They won't do that. And in fact, the Congress just passed a resolution against trying to prevent him from withdrawing troops from Syria and Iraq. So, you know, this is a very bizarre situation where Trump is completely contradictory and incoherent. And, you know, he does, as I say, oh, let's make peace with Korea, but let's attack Iran and Venezuela. But we should be having a discussion about this. And the media is just crazy. Anything that Trump does is wrong. And if he makes peace with Iran, with Korea, it's wrong, except if he attacks somebody.
Jim Kavanaugh is right. The Democrats could attack Trump and make a real fool out of him, but they won't because they actually agree for a regime change in Venezuela.
They do.
They have the same position on Iran.
There's one neoliberal, neoconservative foreign policy. That's it. They're all in agreement.
We're out of time. We're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. We were joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarik. In our first segment, we were joined by Jacqueline Lookman from the Lookman Nation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.